President, I move that further proceedings under the roll call be dispensed with, the sergeant-at-arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Today's chaplain is the Reverend Bob Hart from the Transfiguration Catholic Church in Oakdale.
Loving God, blessed Spirit, understanding, and all-powerful Yahweh, your blessings reach to the ends of the earth. Confirm us in our common task that we may walk together with you and with each other. Bless the men and women gathered here, the senators and staff who have been entrusted with the responsibility of seeing to the well-being of the people of Minnesota. From the abundance of your mercy, enrich them and safeguard them. May all their work be in a spirit of cooperation and be brought together through your power and guidance. Watch over them and guide them as only you can. Give them the wisdom necessary to make prudential judgments, especially during times of fiscal uncertainty, and keep them ever mindful of the people they have been elected to serve, particularly those who have so little and depend on those of us who have so much. Then, strengthened by your blessing, may they remember to always be thankful to you and bless you with unending joy. I ask this in the name of the God or Spirit of each person's understanding, whoever or whatever that may be. Amen.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Secretary will take the roll.
Anderson, Bach, Berglund, Betzel, Bonoff, Carlson, Chaudhry, Clark, Cohen, Dahl, Dibble, Dill, Dahl, Erickson, Ropes, Fishbach, Phoebe, Foley, Fredrickson, Gerlach, Gimsey, Hand, Higgins, Ingebrigtsen, Johnson, Jungbauer, Kielash, Koch, Coring, Kubli, Langseth, Latz, Limmer, Laurie, Lynch, Marty, Metzen, Michelle, Waugh, Murphy, Olsen, Olson G, Olson M, Ortman, Pappas, Parisot, Perry, Pogemiller, Pretner, Solon, Rest, Roebling, Rosen, Rummel, Saltzman, Saxhog, Scheid, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Skogan, Sparks, Stumpf, Tomasoni, Torres Ray, Vanderveer, Vickerman, Wieger.
Quorum is present. Reports of committees, Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I move to adopt the committee report listed in the agenda.
All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Next order of business is second reading of House bills. There's one printed on today's agenda. Without objection, second reading of House bills. The next order of business is introduction and first reading of Senate bills. There's one change on the first page. Senate file 3373 will be sent to the Finance Committee. Without objection, introduction and first reading of Senate bills. There's one resolution on today's agenda. Without objection, the resolution will be sent to the Rules Committee. Senator Pogemiller. Remaining Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I'd move remaining on motions and resolutions that we take up messages from the House.
Okay, on that motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails.
This message is on House File 2231 in the Conference Committee Report, Senator Kelash. Mr. President, I have the honor to announce that the House has adopted the recommendation report of the Conference Committee on House File 2231 and repassed said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. House File 2231, a bill for enacting the transportation, allowing road authorities to remove snow from certain roads in uncompleted subdivisions. House File 2231 is herewith transmitted to the Senate. Signed, Elvin A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk of the House.
Senator Kelash.
Mr. Chair, I move that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee report of House File 2231 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee.
Okay, Senator Kelash, a brief description of the bill and what changes were made since it left the Senate floor.
Mr. Chair, the date changed for the sunset on this from 2012 to 2013 is the only change.
Okay. Senator Kelash renews his motion that the foregoing recommendations of the Conference Committee and report on House File 2231 be now adopted and the bill be placed in repassage as amended by the conference committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Secretary will give the bill its third reading.
House File 2231, a bill for an act relating to transportation, allowing road authorities to remove snow from certain roads in uncompleted subdivisions, etc.
Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. There being 47 ayes and 15 nays, the bill is passed. It's title agreed to.
Next message is on House File 3048 in the Conference Committee Report, Senator Saltzman. Mr. President, I have the honor to announce the House has adopted the recommendation report of the Conference Committee on House File 3048 and repassed said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. House File 3048, a bill for an act relating to labor and industry, modifying construction codes and licensing provisions. House File 3048 is herewith transmitted to the Senate. Signed, Elvin A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk of the House.
Senator Saltzman.
And I move, Mr. President, that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee report on House File 3048 be now adopted and the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee.
Hey, Senator Saltzman, we heard the bill, brief description of the bill and what changes were made since it left the Senate chambers.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is the Dolly Department bill, and there were two very, very small changes. One was an effective date, and one was just some duplicative language, and we met and reached agreement. This bill was non-controversial.
Senator Salzman renews her motion that the foregoing recommendations of the Conference Committee report on House File 3048 be now adopted and the bill be repassed as amended by the Conference Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Secretary will give the bill its third reading. Are there more of these?
House File 3048, a bill for an act relating to labor and industry, modifying construction codes and licensing provisions, etc.
Secretary, I'll take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. 62 ayes and one nay. The bill is passed. It's title agreed to.
Next message is on House File 3391, Senator Olson M. Mr. President, I have the honor to announce that the House adopted the recommendation report of the Conference Committee on House File 3391 and repassed said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. House File 3391, a bill for an act relating to children, modifying certain provisions relating to children in need of protection and services. House File 3391 is herewith transmitted to the Senate. Signed, Elvin A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives.
Senator M. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the foregoing recommendations in Conference Committee report on House File 3391 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the Conference Committee.
Okay, Senator Olson, a very brief description of the bill and what has changed since the Senate has last seen this bill.
Mr. President, this was a bill that contained some provisions that the county attorneys had requested regarding children in need of protective services. The House determined that there was a period that we missed, and we agreed. So it didn't take long.
Further discussion, Senator M. Olson renews her motion that the recommendations of the Conference Committee report on House File 3391 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the Conference Committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Secretary, give the bill its third reading.
House File 3391, a bill for an act relating to children, modifying certain provisions relating to children in need of protection and services.
Secretary will take the roll. Senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. Being 63 ayes, 0 nays, the bill is passed. It's title agreed to. That completes the messages.
Mr. Senator. President, remain on motions and resolutions. I'd like to take up the general orders calendar. Members, there's a number of members at the Race to the Top meeting today. Therefore, I was inclined not to take up the calendar. So I'd move that we take up the general orders calendar.
On the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Mr. President.
Senator Pogorelli.
I move that the Senate do now resolve itself in a committee of the whole for the purposes of taking up the general orders calendar.
Okay, on that motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogorelli.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to designate the general orders. I think there's 12 or 13 bills on the Wednesday 21st list. And would yield to Senator Kielash, who so kindly progressed his bill yesterday so we could deal with Senator Bedsold's bill. Thank you, Senator Kielash, for doing that. And I'd yield to Senator Kielash.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, when this committee do arise, Senate File 2756 be recommended to pass.
Senator Kielash on the bill.
This is the bill we were discussing yesterday on over-dimensional loads, escort cars, and training program for them.
Further discussion? Senator Senjum.
Mr. President, I have an amendment I hope Senator Kielash will like. It's the A4 amendment.
Secretary will report the Senjum A4 amendment.
Senator Senjum moves to amend Senate File 2756 as follows, page 2, line 30. This is Amendment 8-4.
Senator Senjum on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Senator Kielash. This amendment comes forth basically as you were talking yesterday and describing the training. And I think you suggested maybe 4 10-hour sessions or 10 4-hour sessions. I'm not sure. But I can envision for a lot of people that would be certainly important but inconvenient. And so what this is, members, is an amendment that simply suggests that the Department of Public Safety would develop an online training course, that training course would have testing involved and would be able to issue a certification, not unlike, for instance, you can go on the DNR site and get your fishing license. So upon satisfactory completion of the course and the online test, the certification would be issued. And I just think whether you're in Rochester or War Road or Little Falls or Norfolk, Virginia, coming through Minnesota, I think this would provide some ease and some ability to be able to take this course, to pass it, to be qualified. And frankly, in the end, I think it's probably a lot cheaper and certainly would involve a lot less time away from work for existing employees who are going to do this. So I think it makes sense, and I would urge Senator Kielash your consideration of it.
Discussion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, the 40-hour course is a train-the-trainer course so that after completing that, that individual will be able to train other people in approximately 8 hours to do all the rest of the work on the escort pilot cars. So this is the 40-hour course is really just a train the trainer course. It's going to be administered and developed by the Department of Public Safety, the State Patrol. They are in favor of what we're doing. This has not been vetted with them. I'm not sure that this kind of course can be done online with to the satisfaction of the State Patrol, and I would recommend not supporting this amendment.
Well, thank you, Senator Kielash. I guess I would only say people get college degrees online nowadays. Courses can be delivered. tests can be given, diplomas can be issued, and I would suggest for a lot of people around Minnesota, this may not be very convenient to come to some sort of a centralized location. And I go back to Roanoke, Virginia. What does that person do? They're bringing a trailer through Minnesota or a windmill blade or whatever it might be. They're going to have to come to Minnesota in advance of the hall, so to speak, get their certification, and then go back and get their hall. It just seems to me this is a common sense approach. It's sort of moving into the new way of doing things, and I hope that the members would support this. I think it's simply a good approach to offer the training, but to provide some ease of getting the training that's going to be important.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, a couple of things. Number one, driver's ed is not taught online in the state of Minnesota. Number two, I'm not sure what the fiscal note on developing this kind of program would be, so that's not possible in this bill, or at least in the current form. And number three, folks from out of state would still need to have the certification, but that could be done by hiring escort pilots or escort drivers within the state of Minnesota, which is good for our business and maintains the standard of safety that we're expecting this program to develop for both the state patrol and the private sector. So for all those reasons, I suggest that we vote this down, especially for the fiscal note.
Senator Senjum.
And Mr. Chair and members, I would simply say that fiscally, in the long run, taking time away from work, going to the course, making the drive, is in the end a lot more expensive for the citizens of Minnesota than being able to sit down online and take this course and pass it and get your certificate. It just seems to me the modern, the up-to-date, the efficient, the effective way to doing this. So, again, I would urge your support.
Senator, further discussion. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe a question to Senator Kielosch that brings up an issue with regards to the amendment. So if you have a moving company from out of state, they will have to then contract with a Minnesota company because they would not be able to take this online thing that Senator Senjum's talking about. I'm trying to put that together. So they're coming across the interstate, and all of a sudden they hit the state lines, and now we have to change. Did you look at that at all, or was there discussion on that?
Senator Kielosch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is only for vehicle for loads that require a state patrol permit. So we're not talking about the random person bringing a load or a farmer crossing state lines. We are talking about those over-dimensional loads that require a permit by the Minnesota State Patrol and the department that grants those permits. That includes all the route, the number of escorts required, whether or not it requires a public safety officers to be the escort, or if these folks trained in over-dimensional escort pilot car vehicles are eligible to do this. So these are not random kinds of moves. These are, if a company is coming in from out of state before they get to the state, they would be required currently and would continue to be required to obtain a permit from the Department of Public Safety to move that oversized load through the state of Minnesota. And the other part of your question about whether or not they need to hire somebody, we are within the bill, we are accepting any reciprocity agreements with states with similar kinds of training programs. So that is part of the bill and under the Commissioner of Public Safety.
We're on the Senjum A4 amendment. All those in, Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, and again, just briefly, for ease of use, ease of application, I think, frankly, making this bill just a little bit better, and particularly for the customers it's designed to serve, I would urge support for this approach.
On the Senjum motion, all those
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Senjum, This would require developing two different types of training programs. That costs money. The state is, we've already got a fiscal note, and this program's paying for itself with fees. I would recommend that we vote this engine amendment down. Thank you.
Okay. On the engine motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion does not prevail. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Kielash. Just refresh my memory here a little bit. I'm reading the bill, and the reason we're doing this, have we had a lot of accidents or incidents on the road involving the transportation of oversized loads that is prompting the need to do this? I'm looking at this as a cost, perhaps, to the private sector, to businesses that is not currently being born, and we're asking them to do this, and I'm just trying to understand what the rationale is. Do we have lots of accidents or issues with the transportation of loads?
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, this bill is a department bill. It was worked out and brought to the department by the contractors that are falling under this. They wanted some kind of consistency of training, understanding of the laws, and that is for both the folks doing the pilot car escorts and also for the state patrol and public other public safety officials that do these escort vehicles. Some of it had to do with inconsistency of enforcement, confusion about what laws were in effect. So all of this is the process to develop a consistent training program as well as the consistent understanding across law enforcement of what these pilot cars do and the requirements that they have under state law to do this. So this is part of the this bill sets up the rulemaking process that will be developed with the industry and with the Department of Public Safety to get some clarification on this and also develop the training program necessary for both the state patrol and the private sector to understand how to move these over-dimensional loads on Minnesota state roads and highways for the benefit of the public safety of the rest of the moving public.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Kielash. When you say that the industry, is there an organization in particular that is asking for this? Is there a group or something? Can you tell us who that is?
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, there were several groups got together, including the AGC and some other contracting organizations that wanted clarification. The escort companies that were currently doing the work were involved, the state patrol, the state permitting department. Basically, they worked for well over a year to come up with, they initially tried to set up the training program, decided that it was better to do it through the rulemaking process, so the rules and the training could easily be adjusted to fit unforeseen circumstances. So this bill establishes that rulemaking process that is going to be done in conjunction between the Department of Public Safety, State Patrol, permitting, and the private sector.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Kielash, again. But just one, I guess, final question, Senator Kielash. To your knowledge, has there been any accidents involving the transportation of oversized loads in Minnesota? Anything in recent memory that has happened that would require some additional things to be done that aren't currently being done?
Kielash, Senator
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, as far the reason that this was initiated in the first place was because there were several close calls, circumstances where pilot escort, the mechanic in the back didn't know how to handle the traffic control, et cetera, that's required for handling over-dimensional loads. The contractors that were involved were concerned about the liability, I believe, that they wanted training. When they hired somebody to do the escort pilot requirements that the permits required, they wanted to make sure they had the training to do the job in the correct manner. So this is a department bill, so I urge support.
Senator Jagbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and it's really not a department bill. It was industry that came and convinced the department it might be a good thing, and it's When we use, just so members understand, if you've never been involved with the rulemaking process, it's extremely expensive. It's a pretty good waste of time and effort and taxpayer money. And it only invites those stakeholders ever in any rulemaking process in the state of Minnesota, the stakeholders that the commissions involved or the departments involved decide ought to be the players. So it's very exclusive of the average person. It doesn't take into account common sense, and it does build some new rules that exclude most people from getting into business. So it's very one-sided in the rulemaking process. I've been involved with the rulemaking process many times in the state. I've sat and argued against it. I argued against this in committee. This creates a new government bureaucracy that just costs the taxpayers more money, does not increase public safety. There hasn't been issues out there. And the industry itself can do a great job. They can just take some of the programs that exist around the United States. I made all these points in committee. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We don't need to waste taxpayer money. And that's exactly what this bill does.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kielash, I don't know if you want to comment. I've just been talking to some people here, and I think a clarification. My understanding is this is not an agency bill, that they support it, but it is not something that they requested or brought. Is that correct, and could you confirm that?
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, the Department of Public Safety wants the bill. I found my membership in the Escort Steering Committee. It included members of the Associated General Contracts, MnDOT's Permit Office, the Minnesota State Patrol Commercial Vehicles, the Minnesota Trucking Association, the Mid-State Reclamation and Trucking, Minnesota Manufactured Home, the Private Detective Board, the Minnesota Metro Motorcycle Escort, safety instructors and special counsels, they're all involved in the discussion and development of this bill and the direction it's going. So I would call that participation by a few of the state agencies as their approval of this bill. So I'm getting support from them. They want this bill to pass. I don't know if we can, if that's not good enough to call it a department bill, I'm not sure what else you need to say.
Further discussion, Senator Kielash renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2756 be recommended to pass. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The next bill on general orders is number 57 on general orders, Senate File 3105, Senator Saltzman.
There, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File number 3105 be recommended to pass.
Senator Saltzman on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, over this past session, we've had a number of discussions about we make better decisions when we have enough information on different topics, and that certainly has been true with some of our bonding projects. This particular bill deals with additional information that would be requested when bonding requests come in regarding transit projects and guideway projects. As you know, we made major investments in our transportation infrastructure in 2008. But as we build out our fixed guideway transit system, we need to be as certain as possible about the operating costs. And so this bill would require that when these requests are brought before the legislature, that information, to the extent possible, is also included regarding intended sources of operating revenue. And obviously, we don't have all of that information, but it's very helpful to have. It also requests a report that would come from MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council about where various projects are in their stages of planning, development, and again, discussing the operating cost needs. We are seeing some budget problems within our operating costs, and it's very important that we be able to see what the needs are. I think that it's important for us to have this before us. It helps us to make better decisions, and I would appreciate your support and stand for questions.
Further discussion on Senate File 3105, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to support Senator Saltzman in this effort. One of the observations that I have made as we've toured various bonding projects and as we continue the debate and deliberation about the statewide rail plan in Minnesota, noticeably absent from much of the discussion is the funding mechanism, how we're going to pay for the infrastructure and how we're going to pay for the long-term operations. And this is a step that's much needed and I think will be a useful, provide some useful information and guidance for this body and others.
Further discussion? Senator Saltzman renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 3105 be recommended to pass.
Mr. President?
Pass. Senator Sanjum.
Just one question for Senator Saltzman. Pretty sure I like this bill. Senator Saltzman, would this bill have any effect at all on a private rail company and what they wanted to do with their railroad?
Senator Saltzman.
On that question, Mr. Chair and Senator Sanjum, I'm looking at the language. And this bill has to do with information that would be brought, that would be included in a bonding request. Now, if a private rail company was somehow involved in a bonding request, that information would need to be included. I do want to know that this has the strong support of our Chamber of Commerce. They have worked really well with us in terms of trying to advance our infrastructure. And I appreciate the fact that they understand, as we all do, that the more information we have, the better fiscal decisions we can make. So this would not affect them unless they were somehow involved in a bonding request.
On the Saltzman motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Number 50 on general orders, House File 1320, Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, House File 1320 be recommended to pass.
Senator Higgins, discussion on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This legislation directs the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy to adopt rules to protect epilepsy patients if the FDA determines that anti-epileptic drug substitution poses risks to patients. This would apply to the current request made by Congress to have the FDA examine the issue as well as any subsequent studies. If the FDA findings would necessitate modifications to the dispense as written statute to protect epilepsy patients, the legislature allows the rule to supersede a provision of that statute. The Board of Pharmacy is required to report to the legislature before the implementation of the rule change if it is determined that the rule change would have a fiscal impact on this state. Members, about 1 in 10 Americans have had or will have a seizure at some point in their lives. The anti-epileptic medications are really important to make sure that they have a life where they can reasonably try to not have another seizure. If you have a seizure, you lose your driving privileges for 6 months to a year, and it's a very dangerous, frightening occurrence to people. It is not only just, as you might think, when a generic substance is substituted for a brand-named prescription, but it also might be when the pharmacy switches from generic to generic. So I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Further discussion on House File 1320. Seeing none, Senator Higgins renews her motion that when this committee do arise, House File 1320 be recommended to pass. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. The next bill on the general orders, number 47 on general orders, Senate File number 3084, Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 3084 be recommended to pass.
Senator Carlson has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 3084 be recommended to pass. Senator Carlson, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill does two things. It will make the service contract information more available to the public and also to contractors that do service for the state of Minnesota. We have a requirement in statute that requires after a contract is finished that a small report be provided to the library, which details how the contractor has performed their duties. It is generally, of course, positive because that's what you do with the contract, but at times it can be a basis for perhaps improvement of that contractor's performance or for even barring that contractor. This is generally considered very friendly for contractors because they can be looked up and compared with their past work. That report is in is covered in law in section 16C08, and it requires the report be supplied in the within 30 days after the final completion of the report. It just has things like the contractor name, a summary of the purpose of the contract, including why it was necessary to enter into the contract, where the money came from, how much money was spent, and how much time was spent on that contract, with some specific information on how well that that contractor did. What Senate File 3084 does is provide a bit more accountability and visibility into that system. It lowers the threshold from $50,000 per contract down to $25,000 per contract. That one-page report is submitted online, and or it could be done in paper too, and it is scanned and put into a database and is searchable by anyone who is writing contracts for the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Discussion on Senate File 3084. There being no discussion, Senator Carlson renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 3084 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed, the motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The committee has before it now number 45 on the general orders calendar, Senate File number 1905, Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1905 be recommended to pass.
Senator Scheid has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1905 be recommended to pass. Senator Scheid, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is something that I introduced last year, and it comes out of the small employer health care reform, or the health insurance reform task force from a couple of years ago. And it was a recommendation to help small businesses, namely those over 50 employees, the 50 to 100 employee category, qualify for the same type of benefit, if you will, of guaranteed issue, for example, that the smaller employer market now does enjoy. We've amended it. That piece is not in. We're not increasing the number of employees because a number of questions have arisen regarding what impact that will have on those employers currently in the market. So this bill just asks for a working group from that would be headed up by the Department of Commerce and others and to get back to us and tell us what the impacts of doing that would be. So there is no requirement here to extend the same benefits to that larger, well, the 51 to 100 employee market. I think we need to do something there, but this would at least give us the information to make an informed decision next year. Thank you.
Discussion on Senate File 1905. There being no discussion, Senator Scheid renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1905 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed, the motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 44 on the general orders calendar, Senate File number 1761. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1761 be recommended to pass.
Senator Scheid has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1761 be recommended to pass. Senator Scheid, on your motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1761 is a bill that's going to make a difference in people's lives as soon as the effective date. We don't often have an opportunity to do something so positive for people. It's going to make it possible for many people to have access to life-saving or life-extending treatment for cancer. This is the bill that brings oral chemotherapy into more parity with intravenous chemotherapy. And members might remember that I presented this bill, I don't know, maybe it's a month ago, on the floor. Senator Betzold raised a question, I think, in response perhaps to something Senator Hahn had asked about a cost to the state health plan, CGIP. So I withdrew the bill, and we had a fiscal note drawn up. It was prepared. And now I'm back with the bill. We passed it out of Senator Betzold's committee and out of the full finance committee because there is no cost to the state health plan with the way the approach we've now taken. It's difficult to affix a cost or savings to bringing these two kinds of chemotherapy, oral, which is generally a pill or could be a liquid, something that you drink, bringing that kind of chemotherapy into parity or equal treatment, if you will, under insurance for people who receive the chemotherapy intravenously, which is by far the way most people receive chemotherapy. The fact that oral chemotherapy is covered under the prescription or pharmacy benefit is what is the thorny issue here. And that's where people may max out on their pharmacy benefit. Their copays may be way higher. These drugs are very expensive. They're new, and they're being used more. They represent about 10 to 15% of the market now. We think it may go to 25, 30% in the next few years. But intravenous drugs, chemotherapy drugs, are also very expensive. But because they're delivered under the medical benefit, people generally pay what they would pay for an office copay. So that makes a big difference in affordability to the patient. There's so much to say. I know there's a strong effort against the bill, but I want to say what I think I said the last time I discussed this bill, and that is, this is not a new mandate. This is something that is already covered under health plans. They have their pharmacy benefit, the prescription benefit, and the treatment benefit. It's already there. And people will say, but it's only 27% of the market. And in that 27% of the market, there are a lot of people that could make benefit from the ability to have oral chemotherapy. So, not a new mandate because chemotherapy is already covered, oral and intravenous. What's happened is that the medical developments have outpaced the way we pay for medical services and products. So the medical developments are happening fast or quickly, frankly. Many more oral chemotherapy drugs are now available. There really hasn't been a definitive study, if you will, but I do have, and if you'll notice, I think members received a little packet. I think I have signed three of the sheets of paper. I'd like to direct your attention to what looks like probably the second. It's a bar graph. And you'll see that in a very, I think, unbiased way, the main or the newer drugs from the last 10 years that are available orally or intravenously are shown and it shows you that, frankly, the cost for the oral chemotherapy can and often is less expensive. Now, I know other members want to speak on this. I don't want to bore anybody with, you know, my own personal story, but I will tell you the thing that's not factored in any comparison that the people who are opposed to this are telling you about is the side effects. And maybe I'll get your attention with this. The most common side effects for oral chemotherapy are skin rash and diarrhea. I'm sorry. Imodium works great. One of the more common side effects for intravenous chemotherapy is it beats down your blood, your red blood cell count and your white blood cell count. And when your white count goes down, you probably can't get your next chemotherapy round. I'm telling you, and I brought my EOB with me, my last shot that I had last Thursday that's kind of killing my back, don't feel sorry for me, though it means it's working, was a shot of Neulasta. It's to help my bone marrow build white blood cells. The rack rate, $7,985. You don't have those kind of side effects with the oral chemotherapies. They're better targeted. And when I do get chemotherapy, I get a very pricey, almost $900 medication for nausea. Thank heavens. And I get one that's about $600 and some of steroids so that I don't have an allergic reaction to the poison they're putting in me. So that costs an awful lot more for the intravenous chemotherapy, and I just can't say it enough. I just want you to think about that and what your common sense tells you, that those are not costs that are factored in by the people who are opposing this. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll sit down and let others speak and answer questions if I can.
Discussion on Senate File 1761. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Scheid. You certainly have my respect, and I think the respect of all the members. I know that you have worked a lot on this bill, and I think all of us in this body are sympathetic to the plight of patients that are dealing with the cancer disease. I think most of us have been touched by that. My mother died of cancer some years ago. All of us, I think, in our lives have experienced this, and I think we're all struggling with ways to manage this cost, and I just want to acknowledge the work that Senator Scheid has done, Mr. Chairman. However, I do have some questions, and I think I've got a proposal to make, but before I do that, Senator Scheid, if you wouldn't mind, would you answer or let us know that we have a provision in state statute, I believe it was passed in 2003. It is statute 62J.26 for those of you who are keeping score at home. It is a part of the statute says evaluation of proposed health coverage mandates. And what this does is it puts into statute a requirement that if a chair of a committee over which there's jurisdiction of these issues makes a request to the Commissioner of Commerce, that they will do an evaluation in consultation with the Commissioners of Health and Finance to evaluate the proposal for its effect broadly on the economy and fiscal impacts of these things. I'm just wondering, Senator Scheid, I don't know that this was done. I don't believe it has, but can you confirm whether or not this was a request was made to have this proposal evaluated?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hand, yes, I have 62J in front of me here on my desk, and I've looked at that a few times as chair of the committee. You're right. The chair of affected committee, if you will evaluate mandated health benefit proposals, and it also defines a mandated health benefit proposal. My bill doesn't really represent a new mandate. It has to do with the difference of a copay. You know, we're actually making a statement, which I understand is rare, but we are doing that because of state budgetary concerns, and so I'm not
really making a mandated health benefit proposal. As far as I can see, we're not increasing coverage, and we're not providing new kinds of coverage. And it looks to me like that's what that section does in 62J.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Scheid. I just want to point out to members that one of the content of the evaluation that the statute does call for is the extent to which the mandated coverage will increase or decrease the cost of service. And I appreciate your point, but I think that we are mandating a change in the cost structure. And so, members, I'd like to introduce the A5 amendment.
Secretary, report the A5 amendment.
Senator Hand moves to amend Senate File 1761 as follows. Delete everything after the enacting clause and insert Section 1. This is Amendment A-5.
Senator Hand, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, what this is a simple amendment. It is a delete everything amendment. It is simply removing the language in the bill itself and replacing it with a statement that says that the Commissioner of Commerce must evaluate the health benefit mandate proposal embodied in Senator Scheid's bill, Senate File 1761, pursuant to the process outlined in 62J Subdivision 2, and then submit a report of that evaluation to the legislature by January 15th of 2011. Now, members, the reason why I think we need to do this, and I've spent a fair amount of time talking to both sides, people on both sides of this issue, proponents and those who oppose this, and I think there is some unclarity of what the effect of this is. It depends on who you talk to, I guess. I've been persuaded that there is a significant, potentially significant cost to small employers. In fact, I had distributed a memo from the NFIB, the Small Business Organization, that talks about the fact that these mandates, whatever we do in the legislature that does a mandated change in healthcare coverage, is going to affect primarily the small businesses, 27% of the market. The larger businesses that are covered under ERISA law do not have to comply with the mandates. And so these mandates hit a relatively small portion of the market, and they hit them disproportionately. Now, these are the small business people that create most of the jobs, that in many cases are paying a very large share of insurance costs to their employees. They may have 5, they may have 10, they may have more, but these are people that are paying significant costs already. And there are significant costs, as Senator Scheid has mentioned, to these treatments. And I think before we impose an additional mandate on small businesses in this state, we ought to make sure we know what the impact of that is. And that's what the purpose of the 62J law is, to make sure we know that. Now, secondly, we've just passed in Washington a very large health care mandate on all of us in all states that are going to require certain things to be done. And we don't, frankly, know the full impact of that. We had a hearing last week in Senator Marty's committee where we talked a little bit about those things, but we don't know the full impact of that. We do know that there's going to be mandated coverages. There's going to be a benefit set that the federal government is going to mandate. We don't know what is in that benefit set yet. But we do know that everything that they mandate that we do in addition to that, we have to pay for as a state. And I think before we assume additional costs as a state, we ought to know what the federal mandates are going to entail. And so part of the reason to do this is to postpone a vote on this, a decision on this, until we understand more fully what the effects of the new federal law will be. And so, members, I think all of us have concern about the substance of this issue. We all are sympathetic with people, and many of us know people who are struggling with cancer of various kinds, and we want to do everything we can to keep costs manageable. However, I'm not sure that doing this is the right way to do it, and we ought to do this with, a larger base of knowledge, and that's why I'm introducing this amendment. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask for a roll call vote.
There are 3 hands for a roll call. There'll be a roll call. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Hand, I'm sorry, I'm very opposed to the amendment. I am very sympathetic and understanding of the situation that small business and individual people who have individual policies, the situations they find themselves in. If you read the article that says it's a key vote for the NFIB, you'll see that are talking about things, the bad news that's already out there. It doesn't have much to do with the bill that I'm proposing. What I can tell you is there's a small business, well, small, it's now almost 100 employees. They really liked the bill I had, that I just had previously, Senate File 1905, because they would have been brought in and gotten guaranteed issue. But you know,
they lost their, well, they didn't lose their insurance. It just went up like 40% because they had one cancer patient among their employees. They weren't getting oral chemotherapy, but they had about $1.5 million condition, if you will. And that's what the treatment was. So their insurance rates became something they couldn't afford. And they had to secure a policy that had less benefits. This condition of healthcare costs is not something that I'm directly addressing, but I think that at the end of the day, we would see we'd be spending smarter. We would be spending smarter if people who had to have intravenous chemotherapy could now have oral chemotherapy and have that cancer cell specifically targeted rather than every other fast reproducing cell in their body, which is what a lot of chemotherapies really are, why people lose their hair, for example. You know, costs are not contained. I'm not pretending this is a cost containment bill, but I believe it will lower costs. We all know that in the long run, if we paid for everybody to have preventive care, that in the long run, we would save money. I think likewise, this bill is going to reduce those costs over time as well. It's going to reduce costs for the individual who's receiving the treatment. It's going to reduce costs for the employer who doesn't have to give a couple days or a week or a leave of absence for some of the intravenous chemotherapies that people now receive. Hopefully they won't have, you know, we'll see oral drugs developed that will replace some of those chemotherapies. I think the costs associated with intravenous chemotherapy are so high that it more than compensates for any cost in the system of providing the oral chemotherapy. I just really challenge that. The states of, I think it's Oregon and Vermont, have implemented my original form of the bill, the way it was introduced before we amended it, just treating the prescription benefit for oral chemo the same as you do the medical treatment benefit, and we can't just quite do it that way, so we're doing it through the copay. We're doing it a little differently than they are, and I would say more cost effectively. And they have not seen an increase in premiums due to this. Now, Iowa has also passed the legislation that I introduced. I don't know that the system is up and running or that they've had experience yet to share with you, but it is happening. And I think this is one of those cases where we're out ahead of where I think the plans will be, because I know the doctors are already there. The doctors who work in the oncology field understand how much improved some of these oral drugs are, how much more targeted they are. People don't miss the amount of work. They don't have to drive 100 miles. I saw something, someone referred to me from a woman from Pahrump, Minnesota, who put 14,000 miles on her car going for her cancer treatment for breast cancer. And there are oral chemotherapies for breast cancer now. 14,000 miles. That's a lot of time on the road and a lot of time away from work. And it probably may actually have involved other people taking her there, and is particularly to bring her back home after she received that oral treatment. So this is also about a lot of people in Minnesota who, given the choice, would rather stay home and take a pill a day than go every week, in some cases a couple days a week, in some cases hospitalization for several days, to receive the intravenous. The costs have to be less.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Normally, I do not support mandates. I think very long and hard about mandates. But this is not a mandate, and I'm very, very disappointed in all the misinformation that has been spread about this bill. This actually should be a boon and a help to small businesses, particularly in rural Minnesota, where people who are on chemotherapy have to travel long distances, they miss work, they have side effects, so there's a loss in productivity to small businesses. It also is not more costly for the insurance companies. They are not going to be paying more. For one, the oral chemotherapy is less costly than the IV chemotherapy, and it is not going to be an increased cost to the insurance company. So I cannot understand what the objection is here. It benefits the patient because there are less side effects. I urge you not to support the amendment and to support the bill.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, I think this is an instructive debate, and this is about costs. This is about costs, and it is, with all respect to Senator Pretner Solon, it is about a mandate, because what we are putting in statute is a requirement that the cost, the patient cost for a particular treatment has to be capped at $50. That is a mandate. That is a definition of a mandate, putting in statute a specific number and saying that's what you have to charge for this. Now, the fact is that the costs are going to go somewhere else. We all know that healthcare is expensive. I think that when we talk about how do we reduce the overall cost of the healthcare system, we have to talk about what are the incentives, what are the things that people have available to them, what kind of decisions are being made. In my opinion, that means you have to have a stronger marketplace. You have to give people a broader understanding of what true costs are and who pays for those costs currently, and giving people a stake in those costs. Right now, the prescriptions that we're talking about here, and they're very expensive. These are, in many cases, new drugs, and they are wonderful drugs. And I certainly agree with all the things that have been said about the benefits of these oral chemotherapies. But they do not apply in every case. They apply in many cases, and they likely will be more broadly used as time goes on, but they are very expensive. And as I understand it right now, the current cost to a patient is $200 per prescription for an oral chemotherapy treatment. And these are very, very expensive. I've done some research on this, and some of those prescriptions may cost as much as nearly $10,000 per prescription that is being charged to the patient, $200 in the current structure. A $10,000 cost, the patient cost is $200 per prescription. So we're not talking about having the patients currently bear the largest share of the cost of these drugs anyway. But we are saying that they should bear even less of a cost. And this then raises the question, well, where does the extra money go? It's not going to disappear from the system. It's not going to evaporate. It's going to be paid by someone else. And this is what the small business people are saying, that when you do that, when you say we're going to cap that copay on the part of the individual patient, that just means that the cost is spread around to other people or absorbed by the business itself. And that's the issue. Now, I understand there is a debate about this, and Senator Pretner Solon talked about this. The insurance companies will tell you there is an additional cost. She's saying that they won't. I've talked to them, and they say there is an additional cost to them. Part of the reason to support this amendment is that it puts that decision in the hands of what we already have in statute, a process for determining that. And so my question is, why wouldn't we take advantage of the thing we already have in statute that is supposed to help us sort through the kinds of decisions that we're being asked to make today? We put this in statute in 2003. It's a process that is supposed to evaluate this in an objective way and give us good information. We ought to do that rather than pass a bill that I agree that there is debate on, but I am persuaded is going to add additional costs, particularly to the small businesses in this state that are already struggling. And so, members, again, I would urge you to support the amendment. We need to think about this, understand the cost before we pass the bill.
Further discussion on the A5 amendment. There being no further discussion, Senator Hahn has moved adoption of the A5 amendment. All in favor of supporting that motion indicate, their roll call was requested. There will be a roll call. The secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 21 ayes, 39 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment. It's very technical. The A3 amendment.
The secretary will report the A3 amendment.
Senator Scheid moves to amend Senate File 1761 as follows, page 1, line 9. This is Amendment A-3.
Senator Scheid, on
Mr.
your...
Mr. Chairman, do I need to formally move that amendment, and then I will explain that it is very technical, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't limiting the copay. If somebody were getting two oral chemotherapy drugs, they weren't going to be paying a maximum of $50 for both. It would be $50 each in a month.
Discussion on the A3 amendment. There being no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of adopting the amendment signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 1761. Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, has there been a roll call requested on the final passage of the bill?
There has not been.
I request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Are there three hands? Three hands. There will be a roll call. Further discussion on Senate File 1761. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise in support of this bill, and I'm supporting this bill for all my friends and family, constituents out in greater Minnesota who have to deal with not only cancer but all the conditions that come with a disabling disease such as cancer. So I urge your support on this bill. I, too, disagree that it's a mandate. I think in the long run it is going to save money, and I think it's the way that the medical industry is going, so I do rise in support. Thank you.
Is there further discussion? Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I also am rising in support of this bill. You know, I know that there is this conflict between what is it that we're going to do to be able to control the costs of escalating costs of health care against what is it that we need to do perhaps in the form of setting a limitation on copays so that people can use a treatment methodology that in the end is going to cost less than allowing a process to continue that costs certainly the individual more. If someone is, and I know this from my own clinical practice, if somebody is using an IV therapy, it isn't just that medication that is creating costs in that person's life. They have to leave their job, so they've lost a day of work. That employer has lost a day of productivity from that employee, and they now go to who knows where. In rural Minnesota in particular, there's long distances. It isn't just a brief kind of time that you move away from your employer. You have to go long distances to get sometimes the kind of therapies that you need in these clinical situations. Allowing a parity in the payment for oral chemotherapy saves all of those costs, many of which are also absorbed by a person's health insurance. So I am confident that this parameter that we're establishing on something that's already covered by health insurance will be a cost savings. I was impressed in the hearings about the absence of evidence from others' experience who have implemented this legislation that there are measurable cost increases as a result of this particular legislation. So with those things, those two important things to me, that it is cost-containing, it saves an individual a great deal of money because they don't have to incur the additional costs that go along with IV therapies. They can take it in their home, they don't have the extraordinary side effects, and because there really has been no demonstrated increase in the costs as a result of this policy in other states that have implemented various forms of this legislation. So I urge the members of this body to support this legislation, even though under other circumstances where it does demonstrate a mandate, it does demonstrate an increased cost. In this case, that hasn't been demonstrated, so I'm hoping you'll be able to find a way to support this bill.
Senator Limmer. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, I just would like to remind everyone that this, I don't know how we cannot say this is a mandate when we have in law saying that this will be the price. And this is, with all respect to my colleagues, this is not a cost-controlling device. All this does is limiting the cost to the patient, lowering it from $200 to $50. That's what the bill does. The cost of the treatment doesn't go away. It doesn't change. And I think there is debate. Clearly, we've heard the debate about differences of view about where these costs are and who's going to pay for them, but the costs are not going to go away. The cost of the drug is the cost of the drug. If we say the patient now pays $200, the rest of it is paid by the insurance company or spread around among the premium, the other premium payers. If we lower that premium or that cost to the individual, then the difference is going to be absorbed by the insurance companies or other premium payers. It doesn't disappear. And so this is a desire to shift the cost, make that cost smaller. But again, this is again, the premium or the part that is paid by the patient today is a very low cost compared to the total for these drugs. But I we can vote whatever we want to. I know there's great sympathy. I have that sympathy as well as others for what cancer patients are going through. But we need to make decisions that are based on fact, and I think that as a legislature we should avoid, especially in healthcare, the desire to mandate prices as a way of affecting the changes that we all desire. That is not the method to do this. We need more information. We need a fuller understanding of how the market works. We need to give people information. We need to give people choices. But mandating costs, mandating prices at the legislative level, we've been doing that for years. We just saw a major effort at the federal level to do this. These things will not reduce the cost to the healthcare industry. They will raise costs. They will make it less efficient. And so, members, I would urge us to not do this.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Han, you're misinformed. That is not accurate. You're not taking into account the fact that there are facility charges, there are nurse charges, there are equipment charges for the IV. There is the time that is spent in the infusion room. These are additional charges that will go away. None of those are necessary with oral therapy. And the cost of the medication is less than the cost of the IV medication in the first place. So it is saving everybody money.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, I personally want to thank Senator Scheid for bringing this bill before the body today. And I rise to support this bill. And I believe that this bill actually, and I'm convinced, will actually not be as high-priced as others are beginning to say it is. And when you start comparing the cost of this therapy, oral chemotherapy, this type of procedure lessens the cost of all the other supplemental costs that go along with chemotherapy, the drip tubes that you have to receive for 3-4 hours at a time. Many people in rural Minnesota have to travel hours anyway to get it. So you have a couple hours traveling one way, you got 3 hours sitting there getting it, getting the drip. Then you have to stay there a little longer to see if there's any complications. Then you have to drive back home. And then you might even have to, from home, drive back to that same clinic or hospital again. Now, many of our cancer patients have very severe immune deficiencies as they're taking these therapies. And we have to remember, with a person with a severe immune deficiency, we require through chemotherapy that they go back to a clinic, go back to a hospital, subject themselves to all of the germs that might be in a hospital or an emergency ward or a clinic with severe immune deficiencies. And they could avoid all of this if they could get it in the form of a pill therapy. I think this is a therapy that's timely. It's way past the cutting edge. Now it just needs to be employed. And quite honestly, I'm rather convinced that it will ultimately save more money and time than it does in the cost of what we have now. So I rise in support of the amendment.
Senator Hamm.
Well, members, I think that we also, with all respect to my friend Senator Limmer and to Senator Pretner Solon, we're not talking about either or, that in most cases the oral chemotherapy drugs do not replace the IV therapies. In most cases. There are some that do, but in most cases they do not. So if you are on an IV treatment for cancer, passing this bill may not change that for you. There are some treatments that are, but most of them are not. It's if you have a particular kind of cancer that is going to benefit from a treatment of an oral treatment, then you will be prescribed that drug. If you have other kinds that they don't have the oral treatments for, then you do the IVs or the other things. So it's not an either or. And there are costs to do this. And I think we just need to recognize that those costs are there. I'm not saying I know exactly what they are. I don't think anybody in this room knows exactly what they are. It was the reason for my amendment earlier that we do have in statute a way to try to put some objectivity on this that I wish we would have done. But as I've talked to the insurers and the people who pay the costs, they say they are costs. And the costs of doing IV treatment are not necessarily higher than the oral treatments. And so it's very unclear that there is a savings, a net savings to the system by doing this, even if it was a one-for-one exchange, which it isn't. So members, again, I think that we should get some better information. We have a process for doing that. I think that we are passing a mandate that is unclear. I'm persuaded, others disagree, that this is going to add a burden, especially to small businesses in the state of Minnesota. It's going to add to the overall cost of people in the state, and we should hold off doing this.
There being no further discussion, Senator Scheid has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1761 as amended be recommended to pass. The Secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 50 ayes and 9 nays, the motion prevails and the bill be recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 46 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 2471, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 2471 be recommended to pass.
Senator Olsen has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2471 be recommended to pass. Senator Olsen, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a Secretary of State bill related to commerce, and it simply strikes, it has to do with declaration of trusts and business trusts, and it strikes the filing fee. It used to be a fee of $150 to file this sort of trust. And then the second part of the bill is it sets up a $50 fee when there is a non-resident corporation makes a claim with the Secretary of State, because previously they charged 15 cents per folio, and a folio is 100 words, so they've just changed that and made it $50 for that application. So it's a very simple bill, and it actually is kind of a neutral bill. Although they're not making money because they're no longer collecting those fees, they are not having to upgrade their computer system to handle this, so it turns out to be a wash. That's basically the bill, and I'll stand for questions.
Discussion on Senate File 2471. There being no discussion, Senator Olsen renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2471 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 63 on the general orders calendar, Senate File number 2493, Senator Moi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 2493 be recommended to pass.
Senator Moi has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2493 be recommended to pass. Senator Moi, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the crime of identity theft continues to grow and develop in our state. Identity theft occurs when someone uses another individual's personal identifying information, like a name or a credit card number, without permission to commit fraud or other criminal offenses. According to the Federal Trade Commission, as many as 10 million Americans have their identity stolen each year. So with rapid changes in technology and the ingenuity of thieves, new ways to commit identity theft are constantly changing. In Minnesota, law enforcement investigators report increasing use of electronic scanning devices known as skimmers to commit identity theft. A skimmer is a fairly small, nondescript device that can read and store the information contained on a magnetic strip of a credit card. The credit card number and the cardholder's name can be downloaded to a computer, or the identity theft can use a device called a re-encoder to transfer the information to a different card. Recent examples of skimmers or scanners used in Minnesota involve an employee at a fast food restaurant in Eagan who used a scanner to secretly scan customers' credit cards when they used them to pay for food. In another case, a man was caught using a skimmer at a bank ATM machine in Maplewood. Because the devices are so small and look so innocuous, it may take weeks or months for victims to learn that their information has been stolen, usually after unauthorized charges start appearing on credit card statements. Senate File 2493 bans the use of such scanners and re-encoders and the possession of such devices with the intent to commit unlawful activity. Senate File 2493 makes it a violation, and it is a felony offense carrying a maximum punishment of 5 years in prison and up to a $10,000 fine. Mr. Chair and members, that's the bill, and I stand for question.
Discussion on Senate File 2493. There being no discussion, Senator Moi renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2493 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. The next bill, number 70, the author isn't in the chamber at the moment, so Senator Moi, are you ready to take up number 64 in general orders? Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2880 be recommended to pass.
Senator Moi has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2880 be recommended to pass. Senator Moi, on your motion.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 2880, let me see here. I'm just trying to grab my notes. Senate File 2880 is the Guardian Ad Litem Board bill. This bill was brought to us by the judicial branch. Senate File 2880 is attempting to do what we did for the Public Defense Board several years ago by taking the Guardian Ad Litem program and spinning it off into an independent entity that will be governed by a separate governance board. The language of this bill mirrors the language of the Public Defense Board. The governance structure is established in the bill. The bill also provides for who will be able to appoint the members on the board. The members of the board will be appointed by the Chief Justice and by the governor. Three members to be appointed by the Supreme Court. Two of whom must be attorneys, and one must be a member of the public, and four to be appointed by the governor. We also require that the board be appointees to the board be individuals who are professionals with experience and knowledge in the areas of guardians ad litem. In the establishment of this board, Mr. Chair and members, the judicial branch will transfer over to the board the entire base budget that the judicial branch is currently using to operate the Guardian Ad Litem program. In addition to that, the court is prepared to transfer the balance of the Guardian Ad Litem reimbursement account to the board. In the transition, the court is going to be providing support, continue to provide administrative support such as HR, payroll, and accounting functions until such a time as when the board is prepared to take on these tasks. There is full consideration given to this continual support once the board is established in order to minimize the board's costs. Mr. Chair and members, it is my understanding that the budget that supports the Guardians Ad Litem program, the entire budget would be transferred over and will not sustain any cuts, even though this budget cycle, the judiciary did sustain cuts in its budget. I will leave it at this, and I'm prepared to take any questions from members.
Discussion on Senate File 2880. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would the senator stand for questions?
She will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple questions, Senator Ma. With regards to the transfer of the $11 million of funding, now that there's going to be a new board created, that's going to be, is that cost of creating that board, the cost of administering the board, going to come out of that budget, or is that going to be separately funded? My concern would be then that the guardians that are getting the money for doing the work are going to be shortchanged a little bit, or is that not going to be an issue?
Senator Ma.
Mr. Chair and members, it is my understanding that the cost to establish the guardian ad litem infrastructure, including staff and operating expenses, will be around $900,000. That $500,000 will be administrative staff, and about $400,000 will be technology cost. But this will be part and parcel of the entire $12,370,000 that would be transferred entirely over to the board. So I think that this may be part of the concern that the judiciary had about the startup cost, and that's why they're transferring the entire budget over.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. And to that point, then, was there a fiscal note on this? And I think, would you re-quote the numbers to me? I think you said, did you say 90,000 or 900,000?
Senator Ma.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it will be $900,000 as the initial cost to establish the separate entity and infrastructure.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Ma, then, so the so there's going to be a fairly considerable cost, but we don't know exactly for sure, I guess. I'm not sure exactly if that's troublesome to anybody in this chamber, but maybe a little more of a clarity would give us an idea just how many dollars, again, are going to go towards the actual guardians ad litem themselves and how much is going to cost, or if they're thinking that this would be able to be absorbed in the first year, then? Is that what we can assume?
Senator Ma.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, my understanding is that the estimated staff and operating expenses of the $900,000, which is, I believe, about 7% of the existing budget, will be a one-time expenditure for the startup. It will have to be taken out of the entire base budget that the court is going to be transferring over to the Guardians Ad Litem program. So there will be that cost. I guess my thought on this is that the court is trying to address a concern with the courts. They're trying to create more transparency and an opportunity to have this governance board be able to govern this program outside of the judicial branch. And just as we've had to do it with the Board of Public Defense, they're moving it into a creating a separate entity where the court is not providing oversight for individuals who have to appear in front of the court to represent other people's interests, and yet the court has oversight over them. And so it is a, from a policy standpoint, I think the court is making a good decision. Yes, there will be the upfront startup cost, but the court is not making the program take any of the cuts that the court has had to take this year as part of our budget solutions. They're willing to, in recognition of some of the administrative costs that will need to be absorbed as they establish the separate entity, they're transferring over the entire amount in addition to the reimbursement account, of which the money in that account is not being changed in with respect to how it's being spent. Dollars that are collected into that reimbursement account will continue to go back to the districts from which it's being collected from. So in terms of the added cost to the general fund, there isn't any additional cost to the general fund, and the court will continue to provide administrative support to the board in order to minimize any additional expenses that they will have to absorb.
Further discussion on Senate File 2880. Senator Vandeveer, did you? Senator Vandeveer.
Will Senator Weil yield for a question?
She will yield.
Is the board also required to recommend a budget for the program to the legislature?
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Vandeveer, just as the Board of Public Defense and other entities that are part of the judiciary budget become sort of separate entity, a separate line item in terms of the consideration for their budget. If we pass this bill and we establish the Guardians Ad Litem Board as a separate entity, then they will have a separate budget that they will have to be included as a separate report under the judiciary budget to the legislature.
Well, Senator Ma, if they're required to recommend a budget, doesn't that sound like they would be then, in essence, coming back to the legislature for funding for this?
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Vandeveer, under current law, the Guardian Ad Litem program is a budget item for the judiciary. If this transfer takes place, the Guardians Ad Litem Board will be a budget item in the judiciary budget in Senator Foley's committee. Just as budget considerations under current law, when we look at cuts to the judiciary, it is the judiciary's option on how they recommend the cuts within that budget. In this instance, if this bill passes, the Guardians Ad Litem Board will be an independent entity. They will have a base budget, but that budget then will become, I think, will become a separate budget under Senator Foley's budget to look at when he's looking and contemplating cuts.
Boy, that's a head spinner. Does Senator Foley's spend different money than the rest of the legislature to his committee?
Senator Ma.
Mr. Chair and Senator Vandeveer, I guess, you know, English is my second language, so I'm having a hard time understanding your question.
Well, then I'll make a comment. What we're doing here is just growing government, but we're growing the judiciary, and all I've heard from the folks in Washington County is that they don't have enough money to do what they're doing now. And here we are making more plans for what they're going to do without any money to do it at a time when we should actually be going, I think, in the opposite direction.
There, further discussion on Senate File 2880. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. President. And Senator Vandeveer, not any new money. What I had within my budget area covered the courts, the appellate courts, the various other elements of the judiciary branch And that was what it was and what it is now, and it won't be adding any money. It's what we're currently using.
Further discussion? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've been reading the bill, and I remember in committee as it went through, I failed to ask a question of Senator Moore, but Senator Moore, I wanted to bring your attention to the makeup of the board. I noticed that it's entitled the State Guardian Ad Litem Board, but there's no Guardian Ad Litem members on the board. And I'd like to introduce an A4 amendment to, I can explain it later.
Secretary, report the A4 amendment.
Senator Limmer moves to amend Senate File 2880 as follows, page 3, line 20. This is Amendment A-4.
Senator Limmer, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Moab, and members, the A-4 amendment would require the board to have at least one guardian ad litem to be appointed by the courts, and the other authority that would appoint would be the governor. So there'd be two guardian ad litem members, professionals that are being affected by this board, actually as a member. I think that would give some insight to the other members, as well as having, at least the title of the name live up to the board's purpose, as well as the identity of it. I'll stand for questions.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer has shown me the A4 amendment. I'm not unfamiliar with this issue. As this bill has gone through the various committees, there is a professional organization that has been pushing for this to go onto the bill. I've had some long discussions with the judiciary about putting this specific language in the bill. And I've reached the conclusion, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, that I think that the language that we have in the bill sufficiently and adequately addresses the concerns of the association that wants to specifically name guardians ad litem in the makeup of the board. And the reason why I've come to that conclusion, I am comfortable saying that I would rather this amendment not go on the bill, is that if you look at the language of the bill, first of all, the Chief Justice or the Supreme Court gets to appoint 3 members, and 4 members are appointed by the governor. And the presumption here is that individuals who have an interest in going on this board will make an application to the Supreme Court and to the governor's office. And in statute, we are asking that the candidates that are being considered by both the Supreme Court and the governor be candidates who demonstrate an interest in maintaining a high-quality, independent guardian ad litem program for the advocacy of the best interest of children as required in juvenile and family court. The language also says that the candidate shall be well acquainted with a guardian ad litem program, as well as laws that affect a guardian ad litem's work, including, and then we list all the statutory sections. My sense is that given the kind of requirement that we've put into statute, that guardians ad litem who apply as appointees to either the Supreme Court or the governor's office will be individuals who are more than qualified and will certainly fulfill those requirements. And so, members, I ask that we not put the A4 amendment into the bill.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Moore, I hope you don't, in your comments, don't think that the current guardian ad litems don't care for the interest of children in the state of Minnesota. I kind of got a hint that maybe you might be going in that direction. Guardian ad litems, by what I can tell, are professional. They care about their client base. They're trying to do the best job they can. But to establish a board, a professional board that doesn't, well, this might even be the only professional board that doesn't have the professionals on the board. So I think of these 7 members, allowing 2, a mere 2, be on this board would not only be necessary, but I think it should be expected. And so in light of that, I hope that the members of the Senate would agree with me on that logic.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I rise in support of the Limmer Amendment. And I think, Mr. Chair and members, it's a very straightforward thought process to me when we look at putting boards together, at least at the experience that I've had in over the last 4 years, that you're going to have somebody there involved that's a practitioner. I'll give you, for instance, public safety boards. If you're going to put together something that deals with public safety, you're going to ask for a law enforcement professional. I know they're on those boards now. Fire safety wouldn't be no different. You're going to have a fireman on them, that board, if you're going to be talking about fire safety issues. Or the Board of Judicial Standards and Ethics. I know there's lawyers on there. So it just seems to make sense that we have professionals that are actually working in the profession on this board. And again, I think that's a reasonable request. I stand again in favor of the amendment. And, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call vote.
Are there three hands? There will be a roll call. Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, I don't want the members or the public who are watching this to be under the mistaken impression that somehow I'm opposed to guardians ad litem beyond this board. In fact, I kind of hope that the guardians who are interested in this board would apply, and that under my language, there's a highest possibility that all seven members of the board may end up being guardians ad litem. And so the language in the bill does not prohibit guardians ad litem for applying, and if they qualify, it would be great that all of the members on this board could be guardians, people who are already guardians ad litem. So nothing in this language explicitly prohibits people who are guardians ad litem from being on this board. In fact, I think that by specifying only two of them might lead to the mistaken impression that since two positions have been filled by guardians ad litem, that perhaps the rest of the other positions ought to be filled by people who are not guardians ad litem in order to balance the board. And so I am not hostile to the idea that this board should have guardians ad litem. In fact, the language specifically says that people should be well qualified. And I think that my language offers the broadest opportunities for the greatest number of guardians ad litem to participate.
Further discussion on the A5 amendment. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Moi, I believe that the amendment has language that says at least one of whom must be. That means they could all be, or half of them, or any other division of that. But at least one would not be too little.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment with regards to Senator Moi, and I understand that it could be everybody, should that ever happen. I don't think that's ever going to happen, but the bottom line is that the people that are the appointing authorities here get their authority through statutory language, and we are the ones that actually write that. So for us to be doing it different for this particular group, I think it just seems to be a little different. I just don't see any reason why our governing body wouldn't have the foresight to do that. I just think it's just good policy to stay with that. And after all, we are the ones that will be telling both the governor and also the other agent or the other agency, the whoever's appointing them, give them direction, and they get their direction from the House and the Senate. So,
further discussion on the A5 amendment, A4 amendment. There being no further discussion, the secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 30 ayes, 28 nays, the amendment is adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2880. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Senator Moi would yield for a question.
She will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Moi. Senator Moi, does the power of this new board, if we establish it, extend to selecting and appointing guardians ad litem on a statewide basis, or will the local county courts still be able to appoint the guardian ad litems that work in their local community?
Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, the plan is that the way that the program is currently being run will stay as is. There's nothing in the language changing how the program is being run within each of the judicial districts.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Senator Moi would yield yet again.
She will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Moi. Was there not testimony that that was the intent, Senator Moi, that the intent was eventually to move this to the statewide board and have them appoint and approve all the appointments for the guardian ad litems? I thought that was the testimony, but correct me if I'm wrong on that, Senator Moi.
Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, I don't recall any testimony specific to the operations and management of the different guardian ad litems program. What I heard from the court is that this is establishing a governance structure that will take the place of what currently the judiciary is doing in terms of oversight for the guardian ad litem program, but that it should not have any impact whatsoever on how the program is being run in each of the judicial districts. That being said, there's also nothing in the language, though, that once the board is formed, then the board itself, in its job as a governance body, won't take a look at the Guardians ad litem program and do their job. But nothing in the bill directs the new Guardians ad litem board on how they should govern and manage.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 2880? There being no further discussion, a roll call has been requested. The secretary will take the roll. Okay. I was mistaken. A roll call had not been requested on the bill. Senator Moi renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2880 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicates by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when this committee do arise, Senate File 2874 be recommended to pass.
Senator Pogemiller has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File Number 2874 be recommended to pass. Senator Pogemiller, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, on your desk is this bill is a reorganization of, or a sets in motion, a employee-empowered reorganization of Deed and Dolly. It has been through three committees. On your desk is a copy on two sides of the current organizations involved. And the purpose of the bill is simply to find out if there's not a way to meet principles of reorganization that can accomplish budget savings but also get a higher level of service. And based on national literature and on what public employee unions can support, this bill is premised on employee involvement, a time frame for getting decisions made, and adequate protections for those employees in the short term so that they will participate in an effective way to reorganize the agencies. It's an approach that has been used in the private sector. It can work. Our hope is that it will work here. Nothing in the bill forces the reorganization or puts the reorganization into effect until the next legislature and the next governor determine whether the suggested reorganization by the various task forces that are working on this is the right thing to do. Members, I have an amendment to delete Article 2 of the bill. That's the provisions with regards to contracting out that we debated at length on the floor yesterday, and my intent is to delete that from this bill. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A-10 amendment.
The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Pogemiller moves to amend Senate File 2874 as follows. Page 1, delete lines 10 and 11. Page 6, delete Article 2. This is Amendment A-10.
Discussion on the A-10 amendment. There being no discussion, proceed to vote. All those in favor of adopting the A-10 amendment indicate by saying aye. Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, members, now that all is left in the bill is the process for trying to get a reorganization of the agencies in motion. And, again, nothing guarantees a result. It's a process that will ultimately be decided by the next legislature and the next governor. But the hope is that the employee groups working on this, managers, outside experts, and line workers, will come up with some very good suggestions or that help us streamline and get better delivery of services. I would yield to questions and would appreciate member support.
So discussion? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pogemiller. Would you yield for a question?
You will.
Senator Pogemiller, could you go to line or page 5, line 25 through line 30, where it talks about the amount allocated for these functions and services shall be at least equal to the amount appropriated for those functions and services during 2010 and 11, and so on and so forth. What that seems to suggest to me that if we were to merge these, that statute at least continue to require that we could not find any cost savings here, and that's my question. Could there not be any cost savings possibly if we merge these?
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, the way this is structured is that that's in preparing the budget is what this section is about. In preparing the next budget, the suggestion is that the governor and the legislature do this fashion. They obviously can do whatever they want. But another section of the bill talks about, I'm trying to look for that language right now, but it talks about any savings, and I believe there will be savings, will be allocated within the agency or agencies to do their work. So if you flatten out the organization, if you restructure, there will be savings, and any of that then could be and would be repurposed within the agency. That's the concept. And the notion here is we're trying to ensure both the manager group and the employee groups, the line worker groups, that the intent of this isn't just to save money. The intent is to effectively enhance the delivery of service, and if you can figure out a way, which I believe they will, to streamline things, that money could be repurposed in the agencies to accomplish the purposes of the agencies.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Senator Pogemiller. Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, is it possible you could find that additional language that you were, or at least reference it? I don't see it right now, but I'm sure. I'm not doubting you're saying it, but 6.9,
it is,
they say.
Mr. Chair, this was added in the finance. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pogemiller.
This was added in the finance committee, and I think the language is 6.9 to 6.11.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Pogemiller. That seems to... Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, in your opinion, then, that sentence trumps the reference that I just made in lines 525 to 530, or 529, I guess. 525 to 529, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, I think they kind of work together, but keep in mind it's all premised on preparing a proposed budget. So at the end of the day, the legislature and the governor will decide the level of spending here. This is to indicate that the intent in your reorganization is for you to allocate resources appropriately within the agency. It will be a second battle. For example, with a $5 billion budget, it potentially could be a second battle whether there has to be a reduction in the money to the agency. But it won't be because you reorganized. It'll be because we have a larger problem.
Senator Chair,
Senator Pogemiller, thank you very much.
Further discussion on Senate File 2874. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am concerned about Section 6, and I'm not sure why we have to tell the next governor how he has to put that budget together. Why do we say that we have to include an amount that is adjusted for inflation and including substantial increases for staff development, and then it says that it can't require the layoff of any classified employees or unclassified employees covered by a collective bargaining agreement? Why do we have to tell the next governor that they have to have all of those provisions in their next budget, Senator Pogemiller?
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, the purpose for that is to fulfill one of the, what the experts tell us. If you are asking managers and employees to give deep consideration to reorganizing how they do their work, you need to provide some level of safety to them that it's not about eliminating their jobs, and that's human nature. If someone thinks, oh, you want me to meet all summer long and talk about how I can eliminate my job, then probably somebody would not be as productive or as creative as you would hope. All this language says is that the intent is to ask, because all you can really do is ask the governor to do this, and the next legislature can't be forced to do this. What you do is you say, look, here's the intent. This group is coming up with some good ideas. If they're good ideas, we would like you to repurpose, legislature and governor, repurpose those resources internal to their agency so they can do better work or more work than they're doing today. But there's no guarantee, and I think the employee groups know that. We can't make the next governor or the next legislature do this. All we can do is set up conditions under which the opportunity that they would are suggested. That's really all this does.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it does say that the governor shall include an amount to cover the functions, and it's pretty directive. It's going to be in law. You say we can't make the governor do it, but then he's breaking our state law that if this would happen to go into effect, it seems rather limiting to me for the governor to try and put together a budget that might include some of his or her own reforms. And so, I would like to make an amendment just to delete Section 6.
And Senator Roebling, you're making that as an oral amendment?
It's an oral amendment. It's just delete Section 6.
Does the secretary have the necessary information to report the amendment?
Senator Roebling moves to amend Senate File 2874 as follows. On pages 5 and 6, delete Section 6.
Senator Roebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, You know, as a legislative body, we can do this when it comes to putting together our budget, but I don't think that it's necessary for us to tell the next governor of Minnesota that they must do this. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me. I understand Senator Pogemiller is trying to give some assurances to certain employee groups, but I think that the next governor needs to have a lot of flexibility. They're going to have to be very creative, and we shouldn't be setting any mandates on them like this. I mean, certainly we would expect them to consider the recommendations of a reorganized structure, but to say that they must be this prescriptive, that they have to include an adequate or a substantial increase for staff development, that it has to be adjusted for inflation, when maybe no other part of that budget will be, because we won't have the resources for that, but this part of it will have to be. It just doesn't make sense to me that we would try and force this upon our next governor, so I ask for your support.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I do not support Senator Roebling's motion. I'm starting to get the impression, Senator Roebling, no matter what I have in this bill, you're going to be against it, but that's fine. I've explained numerous times in the committees, let me explain now again, why the construct of this creates the best possibility for success. The national scholars and private businesses have based a lot of their reorganization work on principles that appear to have been successful over the years. And those principles are, one, some semblance of job security allows workers to embrace change. Secondly, training for new functions and new jobs is something that you would like to do as a matter of what you're doing. If you reorganize the agency in a way where there will be different types of jobs or fewer jobs with different responsibilities, you will want to have employees know that they will be trained for those purposes. Thirdly, the overall objective should be about satisfying the outside customers, in this instance, the taxpayers or the workers or the businesses that use these agencies. You absolutely should try to, another criteria is you absolutely should try to flatten out the organization. So there will be certain types of jobs that are eliminated here. And then finally, involving frontline workers in these reorganization discussions is absolutely crucial to getting a good result. And Senator Roebling, I have explained, and I'll explain again, that there's nothing we can write this year that forces any governor or any future legislature in the end to do anything. That's the way it works. What this is intended to do is create language that allows some hope or observance by these various employees that we're asking, both managers and line workers, to genuinely participate in restructuring the way they do their work. Help us create change. And I think the way the bill is drafted does that. It has the strong support of the employee groups affected, management groups and line worker groups, and it has the strong support of the commissioner of one of the agencies. It seems to me that if you can put together that kind of coalition of people supporting it, you might want to hang with that rather than force those people away from the table. And then the last comment I'd make is, I've been in the legislature a number of years, and I am not aware of a successful process for reorganizing significant reorganizations of state agencies during all those years. I think we should try to learn from the private sector, and I think we should try something that potentially could have very significant dividends for the long term. So I oppose the Roebling Amendment. I think it is unwise to try to, I don't think this is Senator Roebling's intent, but by deletion of that language, you will send a signal that there is something to fear by embracing change. And I believe that's the wrong signal to send.
Members, we now have the Roebling Amendment in writing. It's the A51 Amendment. Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, we may not be telling the governor that they have to do this explicitly, but they still have the legislature. And so, I mean, there is no promise to any employee that by the time this would be adopted and this reorganization would occur, that there wouldn't be some cuts in budgets, that maybe they won't get substantial increases for staff development. You know, it's a long process, and as you said, we can't bind future governors or legislators, so why do we have to put this in the bill? It isn't true that I dislike the bill in its entirety. In fact, if we get this out of here, I'll vote for the bill, but I'm very uncomfortable with this in it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Senator Robin, I would hope for the bill. Hope you'd vote for the bill even if you aren't successful on your amendment. And what I'm suggesting to you is that your amendment, I believe, guarantees that the bill will not be successful, because there will be a signal to employees that somebody really doesn't care about retraining or repurposing. All they really care about is saving money. And I think, just think of yourself and your own employment history. Wouldn't you embrace change differently if someone said, no, we're not trying to just eliminate your job, we're trying to do this better, and we may ask you to do your job differently, but if they say to you, look, we need you to reorganize so that we can eliminate a bunch of your friends from their work, I think people, just human nature is you view that differently. That's why the private sector and a lot of the national people who work in these areas suggest following these kinds of principles when you reorganize. And Senator Roebling, change is hard. And I'm asking you to consider that the fear you have is not one you should be concerned about.
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, the governor could probably be convinced that they should handle this in the way some of the private sector employers have handled it, without having it mandated to them in law. And so I just think the mandate is unnecessary. And I don't know. I was thinking about asking for a roll call, but it looks like there's a lot of members. I'll ask for a roll call.
Are there three hands for a roll call? There are three hands. There will be a roll call. Further discussion on the Roebling A51 amendment. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm going to rise in support of the Roebling amendment, and only to say that, just looking through the rest of the bill, I think the bill is fundamentally good. I do think Section 6 is a deal breaker, at least downstairs, and I would fear that an otherwise good bill will find its way into veto land with this language. So if we can take this out, I think we accomplish good things, and the bill moves forward. But I do fear that this governor or most governors would not probably sign a bill with this kind of language in it.
Further discussion on the Roebling A51 amendment? There being no further discussion, there's been a request for a roll call on the Roebling A51 amendment. The secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 23 ayes, 36 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2874.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm wondering if Senator Pogemiller, I've been listening to this discussion about the bill and the provisions and the debate about this particular section. And Senator Pogemiller, you've talked quite a lot about the good that there is in embracing this idea of change and that we ought to bring some change to state government. I think that is an idea that you'll find pretty broad acceptance for across the members of the body, I think certainly on our side of the aisle. And this is just not a question particularly on the bill, but I guess it might be an amendment if you're willing to contemplate it. But is there an interest on your part as we talk about change and doing state government differently to open up the PELRA laws and look at the kinds of structures that we have in place for dealing with public employees and recognizing the need to do that differently, given that those kinds of constraints that are put on employers in the public sector do not exist in the private sector and that they are costly and burdensome and very difficult to manage. So in the course of doing this reorganization that we're contemplating, is there an interest in saying, let's talk about this, let's bring that issue up, let's talk about reexamining the PELRA law structure with an idea of reforming it to make it consistent with private sector kinds of employment practices. Is that something you would contemplate?
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, that's a bigger issue than this simple piece of legislation, but I'm absolutely interested in any ideas that create more efficiency or streamline the process or create better delivery of services for our taxpayers. So when those ideas are presented, I on a personal level, I'm perfectly willing to consider them and would hope that jointly we would all support things that we thought move things forward.
Further discussion? There being no further discussion, Senator Pogemiller has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2874 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 560 be recommended to pass.
Senator Latz has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 560 be recommended to pass. Senator Latz, on your motion.
Members, this is the consensus expungement reform bill that you have before you. On your desk, you will find support from the Council on Crime and Justice, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. This is a narrowly focused effort to allow those who receive dispositions on their criminal charges that do not result in convictions and reach the consensus of the prosecutor, the judge, and the defense that at the end of the process, some period of conditional probation or stay, that the matter be expunged or sealed from their record from public view, that in fact be allowed. Currently, under Minnesota statute, you can get charges which are resolved in favor of the defense, meaning there's no conviction and no plea of guilty, expunged under the statute, then, and that applies to records both within the judicial branch and outside the judicial branch, specifically at the BCA and so on. But it does not extend to stays of adjudication, which are pleas of guilty that are not adjudicated and where there's no conviction, and it does not apply to diversions where the prosecution is suspended. This bill extends expungement to those two categories. Both of those categories only happen when the judge and the prosecutor and the defense agree to it at the time that the charge is disposed of. This would streamline the process for expungement by allowing for administrative expungement to be agreed upon at the time of the initial disposition of the case rather than requiring a separate formal motion at the end of usually a one-year period of time. It would therefore create more efficiency within the judiciary. It would also result in more people being able to take advantage of it, because many people simply don't come back around to bring expungement motions at the end of the period when the charge is dismissed. And it would also streamline the process for law enforcement, corrections, and county attorneys to access sealed records. Currently, they need to bring an ex parte order to have a judge review it and issue an order. And under this bill, they would automatically have access to those records without being required to go into court for an ex parte order. That is a provision that the County Attorneys Association particularly supported. This bill would have two really good effects on individuals. One is it would make it easier for them to get housing, and another is it would make it easier for them to get jobs, because sometimes just the fact of charges, even resulting in no conviction, that show up on public records can be an impediment to them getting jobs and housing. So this is broadly supported by on a bipartisan basis by the communities that are concerned about these issues. I would note this provision is already in a broader omnibus bill sponsored by Senator Moi, and this body has already acted on this as an amendment to that bill on a bipartisan basis. I should note Senator Ortman was involved early in the expungement reform process and also supports this provision. She's expressed that directly to me. I'd ask for your support and we'll stand for any questions.
Discussion on Senate File 560. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would the author yield for questions?
He will yield.
Senator Latz, to understand this a little better, to have the body understand it a little better, so what you're saying is after 1 year, after being convicted a period of one year and have completed some functions, that they actually can come in and have their record expunged. And if that is true, how does this bill react, or what does it say, what does your bill do with repeat offenders? And what type of offenders are we talking about? Are we talking about misdemeanor, petty misdemeanor, felony? Are we talking about drug dealers, first-time offenders? What would happen if it was a second-time offender? Can you be a little more clear about those?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, first I need to state that this does not apply where there's a conviction. So your question was premised on what happens if there's a conviction. This would not apply to cases where there are convictions. It would only apply to cases where there is no conviction. Either there's a stay of adjudication, meaning a plea of guilty, but adjudication is withheld. The defendant is not adjudicated guilty. There's no conviction entered. Or it would apply to a diversion program where there's not even a plea of guilty. The case is simply diverted through an alternative non-judicial process. It would apply to any case in which the prosecutor and the judge and the defense agreed that one of those two routes was an appropriate way to handle the case. It could be misdemeanors, it could be felonies. In fact, it's quite common now for certain first-time felony drug cases to be diverted under Chapter 152.18. The language here actually mirrors much of the language in 152.18. But it could be any case in which the parties all agree and the judge agrees that the interests of justice are better served in the long run by keeping a conviction off of the record. What happens now, though, is people who, even where a prosecutor agrees that an expungement is appropriate at the end of the diversion or the end of the stay of adjudication, they can't agree ahead of time to do it. It would require the defense to come in affirmatively with a motion, get on a court calendar, send out notices to about 15 different categories of parties, have a delay of 2 months before they can get into court, and 2 months after that if the judge agrees to the expungement. A tremendous absorption of resources by the executive agencies, by the prosecutors, by probation, by the judiciary. And in many, many cases where expungement is automatically granted. So if they were to agree ahead of time, you wouldn't have any of that process. even if they don't agree ahead of time, the process is streamlined and still has judicial review. But that's the kind of cases it would apply to.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Latz, then, explain to me, then, if your statute were to pass and someone would be put on this, there would be an expungent procedure, and the person were to reoffend, is there going to be a time limit where, should this person reoffend, where the expungement would no longer, where he or she would be no longer eligible for that? In other words, if they reoffended the similar crime within a year or even 2 years down the line, what would happen to the record then?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, if the person were to reoffend or violate any of the other conditions of the diversion program or the stay of adjudication, then they would not get the expungement automatically at the end of that one-year period. If they violate it, they probably end up on a stay of adjudication, go back in front of a judge, and a judge may go ahead and enter judgment of conviction, and the conviction's on the record. In a diversion program, they'd be failed out of the diversion program. They'd end up back in front of the court facing the charges as originally brought and would have to defend the charges on the merits at that point. So that's within the period of typically 1 year for a stay of adjudication or a diversion program. If they successfully complete that conditional period, at the end of the period then, any plea is vacated, the charges are dismissed, then that criminal charge is gone and it's gone forever. But there's still a public record of there having been the charge and the disposition of the charge. So if a potential employer or a potential landlord were to go on to Mensis, which is easily accessible on the internet now, and put in the person's name that they're looking up, it would show up that they were charged with certain offenses, and this was the disposition. And the employers may not care a whit about whether there was a conviction. Just the fact of the charge will be held against the employee or the potential employee or the applicant for a tenancy in an apartment, for example. And they will have those problems getting jobs and employment. Even if the case was completely dismissed, they never pled guilty, they never admitted to any guilt of any sort, and the matter was completely discharged. What this would allow then is for the automatic or a judge to easily order that those public records be sealed. And sealed means, expungement used to mean burn all the records, dispose of them, delete everything permanently from the files. That's not the case anymore. Expungement now means the record is sealed. Very limited access. Access only with a court order or, as the bill would provide, access for a limited category of persons in corrections, in court services, in probation, in law enforcement, in the prosecutor's office, when they are investigating criminal matters. And so if they're looking for past conduct, for example, they can look into that and find out what's going on. There would not be a conviction that could be used for enhancement of any future offense, just like there would not be a conviction now if an expungement were granted. But they'd have access to the records on a streamlined basis. So it actually makes it easier for law enforcement in that regard and for the judges as well.
Further discussion on Senate File 560. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And will the author yield?
He will yield.
Thank you. Senator Latz, I would assume there is... I would assume there would be a fiscal note on this, and if all the courts did come to the table with a fiscal note, can you explain why there is not a fiscal note on this?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, there was a fiscal note that was put on this. Actually, it would end up saving the courts money, but we don't get to count those savings in the fiscal notes. Instead, we only count the potential expenditures. It's basically in the BCA where they would have to make some information technology changes to allow for the limited online access, electronic access for prosecutors and law enforcement to these records, and where they would have to screen what they anticipate would be a limited increase in the actual number of expungement applications and orders and so on. The fiscal note was... about $100,000 in the first year, at least the last one that came out. There were three of them, and it It got bumped up a little bit for some reason after the Senate Finance Committee considered the matter, but just by a tiny little bit, $6,000 or $7,000. Commissioner Campion, Commissioner of Public Safety, testified before the Public Safety Division that his agency would be willing to absorb the costs out of their existing budget to accommodate this. And the division as well added an amendment requiring that the agency absorb those costs. The full Finance Committee considered that as well and passed it out as is to the Senate floor.
Further discussion on Senate File 560. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Latz, your bill makes references or at least requirements for sealing records and expunging records. The individual has to have 1 year clear of having no new criminal charges on him. And I had two questions regarding that. First was, how did you arrive at 1 year? 1 year seems to be rather short if you have a person that has a history of a criminal record, and I'm just wondering why 1 year was selected.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, could you point out where in the bill it specifies 1 year?
Senator Limmer.
I'll have to look it up. I'm looking at the handout of the Council on Crime and Justice makes reference in their second bullet.
I found it. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer. The standard period in practice in the courts is for a one-year stay of adjudication or a one-year diversion. On occasion, the parties would agree to, say, a six-month diversion or stay of adjudication. And so what's in the bill now says we're not going to allow just a six-month good behavior period. They want that period to be at least 1 year. If the courts, under the circumstances, were to determine that they felt a two-year stay of adjudication or a two-year diversion program were more appropriate, then that would apply. But the bill provides at least the minimum threshold of 1 year.
Senator Chairman, Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Latz, you and I have talked about how this compares with a pardon extraordinaire, how an individual with a criminal past wants to now be officially pardoned for his wrongdoings. And there is a process for that. But that process, after the sentence is fully commuted, including any parole or probation, one would have to wait 3 years before they get a pardon and have their records sealed. That's 3 years for just a property crime. And it's 5 years, they have to have a five-year life of no crime, no charges, and no convictions. Your bill only recognizes charges, not convictions. And I think for 1 year, gee, if the state pardon board recognizes that you have to have a little longer life of a crime-free life and no involvement in any convictions, why are we being so skinny on a 1 year and then, I mean, 1 year? Being a former correction officer, there'd be guys that would be looking at jail time for 1 year and they'd say, huh, 1 year is nothing. And so 1 year crime-free, no charges, and he gets his records expunged. That seems a pretty swell offer to give a guy who has a life of crime, and now you're going to seal his records up for participating in a diversion program. So I'm just a little concerned that the 1 year might just be a little too skinny with people that have a history of a criminal record.
Senator Lance.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I think if someone had a history of a criminal record, then the prosecutor and the judge would not agree to an expungement in the first place. The reason why you have longer periods of time for pardons extraordinaire is because those deal with convictions. Someone who has been convicted either by plea or trial, found guilty, and served a sentence as a result of that, then I think it's more appropriate to require a longer period of time of a crime-free lifestyle. But the one-year period of time is more appropriate when someone was not convicted, and where the prosecutor in his or her discretion and the judge in his or her discretion would agree that the conviction should not be sought or put on the record, that they would have to agree ahead of time that it would be a one-year stay or a one-year diversion. Only when you have a consensus from law enforcement, prosecutors, law enforcement through the prosecutors and the neutral judge and the defense, would you end up with a situation covered by this legislation. So I think there is a real justifiable basis for distinguishing between this case where there would be no conviction and where all the parties would agree to an expungement, and versus a conviction and a pardon extraordinaire. And in fact, a pardon extraordinaire is quite rare. That's why it's called a pardon extraordinaire. And it's a very high hurdle of a process to accomplish it as well.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, I would assume that the intent of your bill to even consider expungements is to hopefully change behavior of people that get in trouble with the law. Sealing a record gives someone it's a gift. It really is a gift to say that your past is now maybe not forgiven, but officially it's kind of forgotten, unless you get into trouble and we can peel open the seal on those records. But nevertheless, you have a one year crime-free life or a charge-free life, but we're going to give you a lifetime of expungement. I just don't think the trade-off is equal in this case.
Senator Lantz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, in some ways it's a gift. In some ways it's just being entirely consistent with what we already do on expungements. The current statutory expungements cover cases in which someone is not convicted of the crimes to which they are charged. However, the definition is pretty narrow in terms of the particular legal circumstances under which that not guilty result or that resolution in favor of the defense is applied under the statute. What this bill before us does is that it takes two additional categories of resolutions in favor of the defendant and applies the statutory expungement mechanism to them. So it will capture a little broader group of judicial resolution in favor of the defendant than the current statute does. But it's not creating a whole new animal here at all. It's just making sure that we can legitimately capture the cases where a defendant is found to be not guilty, the case is not resolved against them, and where the judge and the prosecutor agree that this is the best long-term outcome. You're not going to happen when you've got someone who's got a string of thefts on their record. A prosecution will never agree to an expungement in that kind of situation. So you're not going to have the repeat criminals that are going to be dealt with here. It's going to be, by and large, the first-time offenders. And they will have met the conditions. Now, often in a diversion program, it's not just a matter of being crime-free for a year. It might include going through anger management classes or chemical dependency assessment and treatment. It might include other programming or other coursework or certain education responsibilities. It might include community service. It might include restorative justice obligations as well. And only when they've completed all of those obligations will they have been successfully in completion of the diversion requirements. And the stay of adjudication is often similarly conditioned on a lot of requirements, not just no same or similar offenses in the next year. Jump through all these other hurdles, and if you successfully complete them and document them to probation and to the court, then you'll be entitled to the expungement at the end of the road, or then you'll be allowed to bring a motion, even if the prosecutor won't agree ahead of time, to bring a motion after the year for the judge to review it. And then the judge would have a little more authority than they have now if they decide to grant an expungement. Right now, unless you fit that statutory category for expungement, the only expungement that a judge can issue is under their inherent judicial authority. That only applies to judicial records. It would not apply to executive agency records like the BCA or records maintained in a police department. And so even if the parties all agree that a judge should issue an expungement order and seal what they can, even if the prosecutors don't object to the expungement, the judge's inherent authority to expunge records would not allow them to expunge the record at the BCA, which shows up on the public mensis because of separation of powers reasons under the Constitution. What this statute says is the executive branch and the legislative branch are agreeing to avoid the separation of powers issue and allow the executive agency records to be expunged when a judge and when a judge agrees.
Further discussion? There being no further discussion, Senator Latz renews his motion. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I don't claim to be an expert on this, but I think this is a good bill, and it should give people that have made a mistake a better chance at a second chance at getting their lives together and moving forward as productive citizens without having a record that's readily available to try to drag them down. And I see that this is a bill that is supported by the Council on Crime and Justice. It's supported by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, all of whom I'm sure know more about it than I do. So I intend to support this bill, and I'd urge others to do the same.
There being no further discussion, Senator Latz renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 560 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, the committee has done good work. I move that the committee do now rise and report.
On Senator Pogemiller's motion, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Well, the motion prevails.
Senator Roebling wasn't sure that the committee had done good work.
She was late in asking for a roll call, Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I move that the report of the Committee of the Whole, as kept by the Secretary, be now adopted.
On Senator Pogemiller's motion, all in favor indicate by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, or Mr. President, I'd like... call for a brief recess for the purpose of appointing conference committees.
And Senator Pogemiller's motion for a brief recess. All in favor signify saying aye. Opposed? The session is in recess. The Senate will be in order. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, is there a privilege report at the desk?
There is a privilege report at the desk. The Secretary will report the privilege report.
Senator Pogemiller from the Subcommittee on Conference Committees recommends that the following senators be and they hereby are appointed as a conference committee on Senate File Number 364, Senators Sparks, Chaudhry, and Fredrickson, and on Senate File Number 2846, Senators Skoy, Olsen, and Gimsey. Senator Pogemiller moved that the foregoing appointments be approved.
Senator Pogomiller's motion to approve those appointees. All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Pogomiller. Well, without exception, the following members will be excused from today's session for various times. Senators Jen Olson, Stumpf, Bonhoff, and Perry for all day. Senator Torres Ray from 12:30 to the adjournment today. Senator Sieben from 11 o'clock to 11:25. Senator Cohen from 11:30 to 1 o'clock. Senator Chaudhry from 12:15 to 12:40. And Senator Salzman from 1:30 to 1:40.
Mr.
Senator Pogomiller.
Mr. President, on motions, resolutions, there are a couple of reports from committees. Have
you
done those already?
Read the reports.
Senator Bach from the Committee on Taxes, to which was referred Senate File Number 3055, a bill for an act relating to tobacco, tobacco control, and preventing tobacco use, reporting the same back with a recommendation that the bill be amended, and when so amended, the bill do pass. And Senator Bach from the Committee on Taxes, to which was referred Senate File 3327, a bill for an act relating to the financing of state and local government, making technical policy, administrative enforcement, and clarifying changes, etc., reports the same back with a recommendation that the bill be amended, and when so amended, the bill do pass.
Senator Pogomiller.
Mr. President, I move adoption of the two committee reports that were just read at the desk.
Senator Pogomiller's motion to adopt the two reports of committees. All in favor indicate by saying aye. Opposed? The reports are adopted.
Yeah. Mr. President.
We'll have proceed now to the sixth order of business, second reading of Senate bills.
Senate files number 3055 and 3327.
Second reading. Senator Pogomiller.
Mr. President, we're done for the day except for accepting some committee reports from the Finance Committee, which will take apparently a half hour or so. And there may be one bill introduction. I believe Senator Hahn has a bill that he wants introduced today. So a skeleton crew will come back and do that. There'll be no further votes today. And the plan would be to come back at 2 o'clock on Monday. 2 o'clock on Monday. So I would hold on the recess and for announcements. I think Senator Rest had an announcement.
Announcements of Senate interest. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. President and members. I'm very excited about all the legislators that have signed up for the Dead Sea Scrolls tour and reception tomorrow at 4:15 at the Science Museum. There is still some space. I think we have about 60 people. But if you would still like to go, there is some space, and we'll see you there.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want to make sure that members know that the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee will be meeting 15 minutes after session. We have one bill that is a mandatory judicial selection process. And I hope you will be prompt and we can deal with it quickly and be on our way.
Further announcements of Senate interest?
Okay, then,
Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you. Then, Mr. President, I move to recess to the call of the chair, but that is only for the purpose of accepting the committee reports from Finance and a bill introduction from Senator Hahn.
On Senator Pogemiller's motion to recess to the call of the chair, all in favor indicate by saying aye. Opposed, the motion prevails. The Senate is in recess.
And, Mr. President, 2 o'clock on Monday. 2 o'clock on Monday.
Without objection, we will revert to the fifth order of business. Reports of committees. There is an addendum. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I move that the reports of committees printed in the addendum be now adopted.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Sixth order of business, second reading of Senate bills. The bills printed in the agenda are hereby given a second reading. Seventh order of business, second reading of House bills. The bill printed in the addendum is given its second reading. Second reading. Eighth order of business, introduction and first reading of Senate bills. There's four bills to be read.
Senators Langseth, Stump, Kubley, and Scoy introduce Senate file number 3379, a bill for an act relating to public safety, appropriating money to match federal disaster assistance made available through FEMA Public Assistance Program.
Refer to the Committee on Finance.
Senators Rosen, Scoy, Fredrickson, and Kubley introduce Senate file number 3380, a bill for an act relating to public safety, appropriating money to match federal disaster assistance made available through FEMA Public Assistance Program.
Refer to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Marty introduces Senate file number 3381, a bill for an act relating to special service districts, changing certain provisions for housing improvement areas concerning petitions and veto powers.
Refer to the Committee on Taxes.
And Senator Fischbach introduces Senate file 3382, a bill for an act relating to human services, modifying procedures for financial management of the Minnesota CARE program.
Refer to the Committee on Finance. The bills having been given the first reading are referred to the committees as indicated. The ninth order of business, motions and resolutions. There's one motion, one resolution printed in the addendum. It is referred to the Committee on Rules Administration. That's it.
Mr. President, then, if there's no other work at the desk and if there are no announcements, I move that the Senate adjourn till Monday, April 26th, 2 p.m.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Senate is adjourned.